Good morning, everyone. This is another episode of Good Medicine is Cheaper Medicine. I'm Shelley Wrench, along with Nash Gabriel of the Gabriel Cancer Center. And I want to talk today about something that's actually a lot happening out in the media, the hype in the media about physician shortage. Do you really think that there is a shortage and what's causing it? Where do we need to go with making sure that patients are appropriately getting adequate care?
Great topic, Kelly. When I came to town in 1990, I was the fifth oncologist in town. By the way, the population of Canton in 1990 was about 100,000 people. It's actually down to 80, 85, they tell me. And yet, we have now 13 oncologists in town.
Are right? there more cancer detected?
No, actually, the incidence of cancer stays the same or maybe a little bit lower. The prevalence is how many cancer cases there are any given day. So this is, the prevalence is cumulative of cancer cases. The prevalence is rising for simple reason, because we are getting better at treating cancer patients. They're living longer and we have more treatments. But that prevalence has not, cannot explain or justify the doubling of number of oncologists in this town yet. There are some people who still think we need another one or two.
So where's the media getting this thought process of...
The fake news. The media, they... That was supposed to be a joke, the fake news. The media actually, they get most of their information from organized medicine. So organized medicine, meaning the American Medical Association, does their own math, and they calculate how many physicians we need and how many are retiring and how many are in training. And believe me, Shelley, it is a very complex math. For example, in the old days, it used to be said that for every 300 people, I mean, generally, in any society, an adequate number of physicians, it should be 1 in 300, meaning in the U.S., we have 320 million people, right? According to that mathematical formula, we need 1 million physicians. Actually, we have 1 million, maybe 1.1 or 950,000. So we are close to that formula. But that formula was done and was created on the days where specialization was either not needed or not prevalent. I'll give you an example. In the 60s and 70s, an internist was the guy who knew it all.
There was a lot less to know then, too.
There was a less to know, there's no doubt. But internist, he was supposed to know it all. And guess what? Internist meaning the internal organs. Now we call them gastroenterologists. But in those days, there was no EGD and there was no colonoscopy. None of that existed. There was something called the proctoscopy. Proctoscope is a tiny little thing, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't go very far.
Yeah.
Right. So in those days, the internist was the one who will analyze the symptoms. I remember my dad, he always had stomach pains, and he went to every single doctor in Mosul and Baghdad. At one stage, in fact, my cousin took him to a psychiatrist. He thought maybe my dad was nuts. Actually, he had peptic ulcer. I was in third year medical school when I treated him for the ulcer before we had Tagamet and Zantac, and that was 1973. Zantac was discovered in 1975, I think, or Tagamet. Anyway, in those days, doctors depended, there was no CAT scans, by the way. Internists used their intellectual powers to diagnose patients.
Now, in a true exam.
Absolutely, true exam, right?
Thorough exam.
But these days now, the interns don't do that, because if you have belly pain, they do one of two things. Either do a CAT scan or they send you to a gastroenterologist, right?
Right.
In fact, today...
Or they order the test and then send them after they get the test results they don't know what to do with.
Right. So we're entering now into one of the reasons why there is this, not false shortage, but apparent shortage. I'll give you an example. Today, I saw a patient who came to me and he said, do you really need to see an ENT specialist to clean a wax in my mother's ear? I said, what do you mean? He said, my family doctor recommended because she has too much wax. So he's sending her to, and the family doc is a good friend of mine. So if the family doc is sending patients with ear wax to ENT to clean the ear,
that takes away a visit for another patient who probably would need to be seen more than this patient.
You go to the...
So that's just kind of it's self-inducing a shortage.
It's because of our culture, the way we practice medicine now. So when you refer everything to a physician, to a specialist, that formula of 300 patients per physician or 300 population per physician, that formula doesn't fly anywhere anymore because every physician, every patient is being seen by four or five, right?
Right.
Which means there will be a lot of demand for physicians. Instead of the old days, you will need, as a good example, we had five oncologists in town, right? You think about it. We had a little bit of shortage in today's standards. In those days, lung cancer patients were rarely treated. They were diagnosed by pulmonologist, treated for whenever they've developed pneumonia, and then they wait for them until they die. Once in a while, they send them to the radiation guys. It was the mid-90s, actually more like 96, 97, when we had no doubt that Taxol, Taxotere, carboplatin, cisplatin, and Gemzar, that these drugs, when you give them to these patients, they actually live longer. All of a sudden, we have, although the number of cancer cases, the number of lung cancer cases is declining, the number of lung cancer patients we treat is on the rise, and more importantly, the number of lung cancer patients in the society, the prevalence is higher. So that obviously means we need more physicians to take care of them. Right?
Right.
Very complex again. Look at this way. I see a patient with breast cancer. I want to give her chemotherapy. She's diabetic. The normal thing actually is what I do. I take care of the diabetes during the chemo. You know why?
Right.
Because I don't want to wait for somebody else to handle a problem and communication or send a letter or phone call. No, I know how to handle diabetes. For God's sake, I've been internist in Iraq and England and here. I think I know my stuff. Same thing with high blood pressure. During the treatment, I handle that. But that's not the standard in the U.S. The standard in the U.S. is that you source out everything. So when a patient getting chemo, she will see, and she's diabetic, she will see the endocrinologist to manage the blood sugar. The problem with that one is the endocrinologist has to know and be familiar with the exact timing and the exact dose of steroids the patient is getting, and exact, but that information is only available to the oncologist. The same with the managing the blood pressure and so on. I think what I'm saying is, our style of outsourcing and using way too many specialists is obviously creating more demand for physicians, which means there is a shortage.
Well, I think, too, that the introduction of nurse practitioners, especially in this era, they've always been out there, but in more of a lower capacity. I think that, you know, with nurse practitioners becoming more prevalent, I think that there's a lot of support from the nursing associations to kind of go along with what the media is saying, that there is a physician shortage, so you need to have more nurse practitioners. I see a lot of that.
I think you and I have talked to politicians about this, and they say that we need nurse practitioners to fill the gap in the shortage of primary care. I can say a lot about this subject because we, in the medical profession, we have never tried to adjust our way of training physicians based on the changes that we have witnessed. I always say when I went to medical school, if the amount of medical knowledge can be measured by inches, like if it was 1 inch, today the amount of medical knowledge is more like 50, 60 inches. Yet, we still spend 4 years in medical school, or in some countries 6 years, or like near UCAM or medical university 6 years. We're spending the same amount of time in medical school, although the knowledge has gone up by 50, 60 fold, truly. The techniques and the technology has expanded so much, which we are supposed to learn all that. Internal medicine is still 3 years training. In the old days, it was 3 years, but the amount of knowledge was so little. Basically, when I did my training in Scotland, I just had to be good historian, meaning take good history from patients, examine them properly and politely and professionally, and try to connect, to correlate formulas and so on. Now is a different topic. Now you have to learn all that in addition to the vast knowledge. Still 3 years. What does that mean? That means we are asking family doctors and internists to do a lot, yet we are not giving them the opportunity in time wise to learn enough, because the amount of knowledge is so big. It gets more complicated. Back in the mid-80s or late-80s, there was a move that interns and residents were treated like slaves, that they were working 18 hours a day, and that was not healthy. And all of a sudden, the liberals and the politicians who think that we should control how many hours people work, even for those who want to work 50 hours a day, we still should tell them. And they enforce the rule that you cannot have an intern work more than, I think maximum is 10 or 12 hours a day. What does that do? That, even those 3 years of training have shrunk. Because 3 years training, when I did it, was, shame on you if you say, I am not coming this morning to the rounds because I was on call last night. Nobody will just look at you and say, really? Are you crazy? Now it's common thing. Oh, I was on call last night, so I'm going to go to bed. That also is impeding our ability to train physicians properly. And all of a sudden, the family docs and the interns are becoming what? Triage. Headache? Neurologist. Nosebleed? ENT. And goes on and on and on. And the nurses society is saying, nurses can't do that. All you need to do is give them a damn degree, right? Okay, let's call it master's degree. And they are doing the same.
What do you think about the new style of, you know, you said a little bit ago that the ratio should be 300 to 1, right?
Was.
Well, let's go back to the old days. And this is something that you and I are actually working on. Is having like a concierge type medicine. So going back to the old days where you actually have, you know, one physician takes care of a particular population, right? Now today they actually make the patients pay for that. You have to just be a member. You have to, you know, pay some big bucks for that, and you don't get anything in return because everything.
Oh, you're talking about the concierge medicine. Oh, right. I love that thing. You know what they do, those docs? Especially in big cities like New York or L.A. or Chicago, you actually have only 200 patients and you charge them $10,000 a year. And you don't have to see them unless it's really necessary. Those docs are playing golf every day because the patient called them and they handled on the phone. It's kind of a neat job they have.
But the thing is it's still the office visit still gets billed to their insurance. They're only paying that $10,000 to get access.
Yeah, because they can afford it.
So one of the things that we're actually doing is cutting down to kind of going back to the olden days, meaning, but using a twist of the future, right?
Yes.
So with our Liberty Clinic, we are now having concierge-style medicine where patients can actually be seen and have good access same day when they need it.
Yes, and you know, I never thought about it, that our program at the Liberty Clinic is actually can be a method of minimizing the shortage issue.
Right.
Because we insist on preventive medicine. We insist on that the people, the primary care providers, are educated and enthusiastic, and they want to do to really practice good medicine, rather than being triaging people, just send patients right and left.
To me, it's going back to the core structure of how medicine should be handled. Because within the Liberty Clinic, they have a vast array of other things that can be done. It's not just an office visit and then they write a script and you have to take it to the pharmacy, or you write an order and you go.
So they can clear the earwax?
So that they can definitely clear the earwax, or they're not going to be working for us. But
I see patients referred to gastroenterologists for intractable constipation. You know what that means in English?
Do I ask?
Full of it. Right. I mean, what does it take really to treat constipation if it's protracted? Castor oil works very well, by the way.
Yeah. But we have the unique setup that if the patient needs a prescription, we've got the Liberty Pharmacy within the same building. If they need lab work to be done, if it's something that's needed right away, we have all the stat labs that we can do within the facility. If it's something that's, you know, less common that we don't do in our own testing lab, we can send it out and have results within 24 to 48 hours. And additionally, you know, we do have the CAT scanner within the walls of the Liberty Clinic as well as an infusion center, which opens up for everything else.
The question is, how do we – it's very innovative what we're doing. In fact, so innovative that, remember, even Governor Kasich's Secretary of Medicaid asked us to go down and explain to him what we're doing, and he wants us to duplicate that work for Medicaid recipients. Our methods, not to brag, the word you're describing, are phenomenal. In fact, even the Liberty Pharmacy, that's part of the program. The main idea is to lower the cost. That's the main idea.
And be able to get your drug very, very quickly.
Right.
Because that's the name of the game. If you're sick, you need that drug now. And you need it at a lower cost. You need to be, not only like at the other retail pharmacies, they might have it available, but how many times have we seen patients that don't pick up their drugs because it just is cost prohibitive? So we make sure that they not only have access, but at a lower cost. And that we get somebody else to help pay for that copay or out of pocket.
Right. So back to the shortage, Charlie. I'm not saying that ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, they also say we have a shortage. There is currently about 10,000 oncologists in the U.S. ASCO says we have a shortage. And you think about it, if you want to recruit an oncologist to Canton, Ohio, you don't get many, many applicants. If you are recruiting in Phoenix, Arizona, there'll be a lot of people who will really be happy to come there at a low cost. So what I'm saying is we have to admit, I have personally to admit, that the change in the culture of medicine that we're seeing because of the change in the technology, because of the specialization, because of the super specialization, that has created a sense of shortage, actually real shortage. And the fact that the nurse practitioner programs are working well, that every single university wants to have their own, is a testament to the fact that there is shortage of primary care, that these nurse practitioners and physician assistants, when they graduate, they do get jobs. In fact, some of them are hired even by specialists like us.
Right.
My major concern is there's some political issues in the shortage of physicians. There is currently something like 40,000-50,000 physicians, something like that, who are graduates of medical schools outside the U.S., who have passed the qualification test, but they cannot get a license in the U.S. because they have to go through residency program. The number of residency program in the U.S. is fixed because the residency programs, that's where we train doctors in a hospital, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those programs are funded by Medicare and Medicaid. and there's only so much money they pay to fund those programs. You get that?
So it creates a bottleneck.
It's a bottleneck. So on one hand, remember, Shelley, it costs average taxpayer about $250,000 to graduate a physician. You have these physicians who are eager to come to the U.S. or work in the U.S. And when you are eager, that means you have enthusiasm. And they come here, and only maybe 10% of them at best will get a job, because the pass rate in the test we do for them in the U.S. is 76, 75. Currently, you look at any residency program in the U.S., they require minimum of 90, the grade to be 90, to be even considered for the training program, because the number of positions is limited. Only 10% of all the residency programs in the U.S. are filled by foreign graduates.
But don't you think, and we had a prior episode talking about the FDA approval versus the European approval, wouldn't it be kind of the same kind of thought process with physicians? If they actually were graduates in another country, what if it's like the EMA, which is the FDA approval process for drugs in that country? Maybe it's lax. Maybe the medical school isn't up to par with the U.S. standards. And isn't that kind of a protection for the U.S. citizens?
You say it's protecting the U.S. citizens. Some people say it is mischievous politics.
Or it could be loss of application fees that we talked about before in the prior.
But more importantly, could it be a turf war? I read a book a few years ago. It was called The 10 Things You Cannot Say in America by Larry Elder. Larry Elder is a black lawyer who actually had a radio show in Cleveland, and he's in L.A. Now he's a very frequent guest on Fox News. And Larry is a libertarian. And in the book, he talks about a lot of stuff. He's not a big fan of Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson and Obama and all that. But in the book, he makes a point and he says, why do we have to have a board of medicine to issue license? He thinks it's a turf war. He said, how about anybody who went medical school, who wants to practice medicine, they can go into practice and let market forces decide who is good and who is bad.
I like that idea. Unfortunately, we've seen...
It's a very slippery zone, though.
Yeah, but I mean, think about going through the process of us trying to get a medical license in a couple of other states.
Right.
For you. I mean, it's daunting. It's costly. It's timely. I mean, it's just...
Right. I mean, look at me now. I had the license in Michigan and Missouri and Ohio and where, Minnesota?
Iowa.
Iowa. And now if I want to apply license somewhere else, I have to go back again to get all the credentials and all the transcripts. Plus, I am board certified in internal medicine in the U.S., board certified in oncology in the U.S.
Exactly, but what other career can someone, they have to apply?
Lawyers.
Is that the only one they have to apply for?
The American Bar Association, again, they have similar rules, and very similar to ours, where every state has its own bar exam, and you have to pass it, and very little reciprocity. They don't have the foreign graduate issues because there's already surplus of lawyers. So not many foreign graduate lawyers want to come practice law in the U.S. Plus, legally, I mean, the legal system in America is so different from the rest of the world. That's besides the point.
Yeah. Now, another thing that is happening as well to try to shore up this, whether it's self-induced physician shortage or a true physician shortage, is telemedicine. And there's been a big push, especially by Medicare, to allow more telemedicine to happen. And there's a lot of states that are on board with allowing, because what happens with telemedicine is you can provide medical advice to a patient, but you have to have a license in the state where the patient is sitting. So there is some reciprocity with some of the states that's going on as well to be able to get you on a fast track to get licensed in different states. But there's so many, it's only like 25% of states, I believe the last time I looked, already has those in place that you can get fast-tracked. There's a lot of them, including the state of Ohio. They approved for the expedited process, but it's still not up and running yet, and they don't have a date that it's going to be up and running. So that's another area with telemedicine that they're trying to, you know, get more patients to be seen. The only thing that I worry about with telemedicine is, you know, who is actually, without examining the patient, number one, how can you really provide good care?
You know, Shelley, honestly, we might need to have one whole episode about telemedicine because the devil's in the detail. If I see one of my patients today, and you know, I see my patients frequently because they all have fighting serious stuff. I see a patient today and get chemo today, and 3 days later she calls or she texts me, she say, you know what, I'm having a sore throat. You know what I do? Okay, get your husband his cell phone and take a picture for your throat and text it to me. And they text it. When I don't like the picture, I text them back, don't like it, get me another view. That's a telemedicine. But that's different from a telemedicine when Mrs. Thomas or Mrs. Smith will call me. I don't know her, but sit on the Skype or whatever and diagnose a disease. Those are the two extremes. The one extreme that I do all the time, I have been doing for many years, is basically part of the concierge medicine. I think it's great for patients. But I know them very well. They know me very well. I actually know also, you know, there are some patients who exaggerate and there are patients who
won't tell you anything.
Underestimate. It's important that I know that so that when somebody who's one of those underestimates, oh, doc, I just have a little back pain. No, that's not little. But when somebody is one of those, they sprain their finger on my guys, they start screaming and shouting, then, and they call, I'm having a lot of back pain. Yeah, I know that. So it's important that and there is an established relationship and the knowledge of the patient and the patient's knowledge of the physician. It's great. To do with total strangers without having, especially without having an intermediary healthcare provider. Like, remember the project somebody wants to work, in fact, I'm trying to do something with Iraq, where we will have Skype, there will be cancer patient there, but there will be a physician sitting there to be the intermediary so that I can help them make decisions for those patients.
So basically, there's a lot of different things that we can do, whether there is true health shortage or a healthcare provider shortage or not. There's a lot of different areas that can be.
Absolutely. And I think the foreign graduates sitting in the U.S. is a resource that we really need to tap into it. But God forbid, the AMA will not be happy with that.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for a great discussion.
Thank you.